From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. And we're following an attack on the campus of Ohio State University. Mid-morning today, campus security issued a warning of an active shooter on campus. About an hour and a half later, the university tweeted that the scene is secure. NPR is reporting that 9 people have been transported to the hospital, 1 in critical condition, and we will be following the story.
Right, but we start in Cuba, where there were 21 gun salutes to former President Fidel Castro today after the revolutionary leader died Friday at the age of 90, setting off tributes but also celebrations of his passing, especially in Miami, home to a large Cuban exile community. His death comes at a time when the U.S. is trying to establish relations with Cuba. The first commercial flight landed today. President Obama delivered that historic speech in Havana in March. At that time, we spoke with Patrick Hidalgo, who was there. His parents had fled Cuba. His mother's family was rounded up, many jailed because of his grandfather's opposition to Castro. His father was part of the counter-revolution launched from Miami. Patrick and Sister Bibi grew up to become activists in the movement to reinstate relations between the U.S. and Cuba. Patrick served as director of the White House Business Council. He co-founded the business strategy firm Future Partners, and full disclosure, was my tenant when he was a student at Harvard's Kennedy School. He's at WLRN in Miami today. And Patrick, given your family's history, relatives jailed by Castro, your thoughts when you heard of his death?
It's been a very emotional weekend, to say the least. I think me and a lot of my family members and friends, I think there's a whole range of emotions from relief to pensiveness and contemplation. And on one hand, he hasn't been in power for almost a decade. So the analytical, you know, side of me knows that this doesn't mean there's going to be a sea change in anything in Cuba. It's very unlikely in the short term. But from a symbolic and personal narrative level, it was interesting to be able to see my parents' reaction. My mother was more happy about it and, you know, sort of positive. And my father was more reflective. And it was interesting to see how this has just brought up a lot of bad memories for a lot of Cubans that fled Cuba in particular.
Well, your grandfather had been a dean of engineering at Villanova in Cuba. He was for social justice, so kind of torn in that way for some of the things behind the revolution, but also against the dictatorial tendencies, you tell us, of Castro, and they included firing squads and rounding up and jailing people. That could have included your grandfather.
That's right.
So a family torn in some ways.
Absolutely. It was – my mother's one of 14 kids. Their story is pretty intense because my mother was put in jail at age 17 for 38 days for being against, you know, the revolution. And she had been a young activist and two of her sisters as well and my grandfather, as you mentioned. And one of my mother's uncles, so my grandfather's brother – got a 20 or 30 year sentence in jail and ended up dying in prison. So it was quite traumatic for the family. And then, of course, undergoing the whole immigrant experience in the 1960s, you know, being an exile slash immigrant in the 60s and 70s in the U.S. was not the easiest thing, especially when you have 14 kids.
Yeah, well, but then you and your sister grew up to be progressives who wanted to reunite with Cuba, despite, you know, many, Marco Rubio comes to mind, Ted Cruz, felt that as long as the Castros were in power, there should be no relations. As long as there were human rights violations, there should be no relations. You were for opening, especially business relations. What's your sense now? Because President-elect Donald Trump has said his administration might overturn and reverse President Obama's moves to open relations with Cuba. Raul Castro is still in charge. What are your thoughts about what happens now?
Sure. I think it's up in the air. We don't know for sure. I think Donald Trump made various promises. At one point during the campaign, he, you know, signaled that he was fine with the changes on Cuba policy. And then right towards the end, he came down to Miami and, you know, met with some of the traditional hardline community here and then came out and said that he would reverse the openings. And there's many pieces to the openings. It won't be easy to unravel all of it. As you might know, there are already hundreds of flights now going from the U.S. to Cuba. We had 200,000 Americans go to Cuba that are not of Cuban descent. So the travel numbers have risen exponentially. And there's also a lot of evidence to show, and this is part of why I've always been for engagement, the rise of civil society in Cuba has been dramatic, and the entrepreneurial and business openings have been dramatic. 25% of the privates of Cuban workers work in the private sector now, and it used to be a paltry number. So that's a big deal, because as people start getting more money and more autonomy, they will start, you know, demanding other things. And that's always been the theory of change for engagement. So if Donald Trump is, if he really wants to be a deal maker, as he often says, you know, I think an optimistic read is that he asks for some changes in Cuba and then tries to, you know, renegotiate a new deal that he can own, which is fine with us, because ultimately this is about the people in Cuba. Or if he does what, all, you know, too many of the past presidents have done, which is kind of kowtow and take a really hard line and demand everything tomorrow, free election, free press, you know, that Raul Castro leave the country, et cetera. It's just unrealistic. It won't happen, and it would really set us backwards. So a lot of us are hopeful for the best, but we've seen the worst play out various times.
Yeah. Patrick Hidalgo, he's co-founder of the business strategy firm Future Partners. His parents fled Cuba, and he's been reflecting on Castro's death. Patrick, thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Appreciate it.
Well, Fidel Castro's death no doubt sparks a robust debate about what Cuba would be like today if he had never come to power in 1959. But here's another important question. What would Miami be today without Castro and the thousands of exiles his communist revolution drove to South Florida? Tim Padgett from Here and Now contributor WLRN in Miami has more.
The rest of the world calls Miami the Magic City. Fidel Castro called it a den of gusanos, or capitalist worms.
Y los gusanos, los privilegiados, los parásitos.
Even so, a lot of people credit Castro for making Miami the nexus of the Americas. They say Miami could not have become an international metropolis without the entrepreneurial drive of the Cuban exiles who fled Castro.
In 1960, Miami was barren.
Bernie Navarro is past president of one of Miami's most powerful Cuban exile institutions, the Latin Builders Association.
The Cuban community, what they did, made everything quicker. Now we have the influx of the Latin American communities coming in, and it's much easier for them to do business.
The only thing that gets me upset is when they say we were a sleepy southern town.
Miami native Arvemore Parks is the author of Miami, the Magic City, and a prominent South Florida historian.
We were a very vibrant town in 1959, 1960. You know, that's the era of the Fontainebleau Hotel and Frank Sinatra and the Rat Pack.
Like a lot of non-Cubans, she disputes the idea that Miami was just a tropical backwater at the time of the Cuban Revolution. Miami's seaside glamour and proximity to Latin America, she adds, could have made it the hemisphere's dynamic crossroads with or without Fidel. Both sides have a point. Miami's advantageous locale may have guaranteed it a booming future, but the Cuban influx certainly helped make that future happen sooner. Moore Parks, for example, points out that Miami-Dade County's population had reached 1 million people at that time. It felt like what she calls an optimistic metropolis. But all the same, Miami lacked adequate capital, the sort of financing base that builds major cities.
This was a tourist place.
Bernie Navarro's father, Gilberto Navarro, helped found the Latin Builders Association after escaping Cuba in 1961.
People who come from Latin America, in order to make business in the United States, need to go to Chicago, need to go to other places in order to make business, because even the banking industry was obsolete over here.
That changed, he says, when Cuban exile bankers began financing Cuban exile businesses, real estate developments, and import-export ventures with Latin American firms. Moore Parks acknowledges the difference that made.
In many ways, it made the dream that we had always had of being a very international city come true.
Even the difficult moments, like the Mariel boat lift, when Castro sent 125,000 Cubans to Miami in 1980, enriched the city, says Mariel refugee Pedro Damian. Damian is a popular Cuban-American artist. He's the guy who designed the rooster sculptures in Little Havana and other Miami neighborhoods. He also helped eradicate the notion that all Marielitos were Castro's criminal outcasts, like Al Pacino Scarface.
Miami ganó otras nuevas perspectivas, o sea, otras visiones. Unas visiones
Miami gained new perspectives, new visions through our experience of suffering Castro's communist system, says Damian. It nurtured and refreshed the cultural scene here. But even Damian concedes the Cuban phenomenon could sometimes darken the scene in Miami. Anti-communist intolerance, Cuban cronyism, and paramilitary recklessness too often cast the city in a negative national and international spotlight. That reputation hit its unfortunate low during the Elian Gonzalez debacle of 2000, when hardline exile leaders turned a six-year-old boy into a political football. Still, a younger generation has brought more moderate Cuban-American voices to the forefront. Castro would no doubt call them the new gusanos. But one dictatorship's worms are another democracy's city builders. Miami and Fidel's gusanos turned out to be a magic partnership. For Here and Now, I'm Tim Padgett.
How do you raise a black son in America? That's the subject of an electrifying TED Talk New Orleans native Clint Smith gave in March of 2015.
All of my black friends were raised with the same message, the talk given to us when we became old enough to be mistaken for a nail ready to be hammered to the ground, when people made our melanin synonymous with something to be feared. But what does it do to a child to grow up knowing that you cannot simply be a child, that the whims of adolescence are too dangerous for your breath, that you cannot simply be curious, that you are not afforded the luxury of making a mistake, that someone's implicit bias might be the reason you don't wake up in the morning?
We'll link you to Clint's entire TED Talk at hereandnow.org. But since that talk, news headlines have made more non-black Americans aware of the talk that parents give their African-American sons. The way Clint described it is poetry, and that makes sense. Clint Smith is also the 2014 National Poetry Slam champion. He's now a doctoral candidate at Harvard's Graduate School of Education, and he's published his first book of poetry. It's called Counting Descent, and Clint Smith joins us in the studio. Hi.
How are you?
I'm fine and better now. This slim volume has so much in it. I want to talk about it. But how long has this been your pursuit through poetry, through spoken word, examining being a black man, thinking of having been a young black man?
I've been writing poetry and taking it seriously since about 2008, 2009. I had a summer internship in New York City, and I went to the New Eureka Poetry Cafe, which is a famous poetry mm-hmm. cafe on the Lower East Side of Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. New Eureka, New York, Puerto Rican,
indeed,
right?
Yeah. Yes. And so I went there and was just incredibly blown away by so much of the work that I saw, and had never been so viscerally moved by art as I had that evening. And I left, and I was kind of like, I don't know what this is, but I want to do it. And mm-hmm. so I've been writing since then, and then I started graduate school the same week that Mike Brown was killed.
In Ferguson.
Yes. And so it was impossible for me to sort of disentangle everything that I was learning of U.S. inequality, and specifically through the lens of race, and then seeing the current sort of manifestations and residue of that history served as catalyst to write this collection. I think for me it was a means of sort of processing and humanizing and seeking to grapple with what we were seeing at that time.
The TED Talk that we listened to actually became a poem in your collection, at least part of it did. It's called Counterfactual. Mm-hmm. Can you read that for us now?
Counterfactual. When I was 12 years old, on a field trip someplace I can't remember, my friends and I bought Super Soakers, turned the hotel parking lot into a water-filled battle zone. We hid behind cars, running through the darkness that lay between the streetlights. Boundless laughter across the pavement. Within 10 minutes, my father came outside, grabbed me by my forearm, and led me into our room, his too tight grip unfamiliar. Before I could object, tell him how foolish he had made me look in front of my friends, he derided me for being so naive. Told me I couldn't be out here acting the same as these white boys. Can't be pretending to shoot guns. Can't be running in the dark. Can't be hiding behind anything other than your own teeth. I know now how scared he must have been. How easily I could have fallen into the empty of the night. That some man would mistake that water for a good reason to wash all of this away.
That's very painful.
And I think part of what I've been thinking a lot about, and it's reflected in this collection, is what I call like the pedagogy of black parenting. And what does it mean for black parents to raise their children in a world that is often taught to fear them? And how does one navigate what is the sort of marathon of cognitive dissonance that it is to grow up in a home in which you feel loved, affirmed, and celebrated, and then going out into a world that has been taught to fear you as a result of nothing that you have done to deserve it? Yeah. I think that's the difficult balance that many black parents and people raising black children seek to find, is how do you let your children know about the realities that exist in the world without making them feel like they have done something to deserve the realities that they'll experience.
Did you have a chance? Is your father still with us?
Yes.
And what did he think of that?
One of the wonderful things about being a writer and one of the wonderful things about this book is that it necessitated that I go have conversations with my parents to get clarification, to get understanding.
Is this the way I remember it? Is this what's true? Yeah.
Indeed, yeah. And it's funny, memory is an interesting thing because sometimes we'll have different ways that we've remembered certain events, and many of the poems reflect that sort of coalescence of memory.
Boy, if I was your dad and I saw this work from this kid that I yanked out of the parking lot, you know, 15 years earlier, I think I'd bawl.
There were a few tears. He has a penchant for the dramatic. So I remember during my book release in New Orleans, I have a poem specifically about him. That's not necessarily in the book, but I often read it at my readings because I think it made the work in the rest of the book possible. It's called My Father is an Oyster. And when I was reading the poem at my book release, he like ran up in front of everybody after the poem and he like smacked me on the butt and everybody got a kick out of that.
Can you give me a stanza? Your dad is an oyster.
My father is an oyster, clasped down tightly on the things he loves the most, his family and his God. He has a calcium-encrusted heart cradled tightly in his chest, bears scars worn from waves that have tried to erode him of this world. My father is an oyster. And I pray that when he is pulled from this ocean, that those who live above the surface will see the brilliance of his pearls.
Lovely. And we'll have the whole reading of the poem at hereandnow.org. Clint Smith, you have kind of a genre of poems. What the fill-in-the-blank said to the black boy, what the ocean said to the black boy, what the cicada said to the black boy. I'd love for you to read a little of what the cicada said to the black boy. But it's almost as if the natural world is speaking to the young black boy. What are you trying to say with those poems?
I've been thinking a lot about the nature of conversation and dialogue that happens between a black child and their parents. And as a sort of artistic endeavor, I was imagining what it might look like to think of what inanimate or non-living or non-human objects, what would they say? Would they provide warning? Would they provide solace? Would they provide advice? And the sort of arc of the book is one that is beginning with a sort of disillusionment with violence and then moving into a sort of resilience and a saying that we will not be defined or singularly defined by that which seeks to kill us or that which seeks to render us obsolete. And so I wrote about a dozen of these poems sort of following that arc, and five of them ended up in the book. And this is what the cicada said to the black boy. I've seen what they make of you, how they render you a multiplicity of mistakes. They have undone me as well, pulled back my shell and feasted on my flesh, claimed it was for their survival. And they wonder why I only show my face every 17 years, but you're lucky if they let you live that long. I could teach you some things, you know. Have been playing this game since before you knew what breath was. This here is prehistoric. Why you think we fly? Why you think we roll in packs? You think these swarms are for the fun of it? I would tell you that you don't roll deep enough, but every time you swarm, they shoot. Get you some wings, son. Get you some wings.
Hmm. Yeah. But you also point out that so many young black men do have wings. Hmm. Now, I hesitate to go right to the basketball poems because, as you say in one of the poems called Ode to the Only Black Kid in the Class, you're everybody's best friend until you're not. Hip-hop lyricologist, presumed athlete. Hmm. So we don't presume that, you know, every young black man, this will resonate for every young black man, but you do also give a young black man a poem about what poetry their jump shot is. I mean, one of the poems is My Jump Shot. Or, you know, The Boy and His Ball, another one, how soaring, ballet-like they are. Here's the paragraph. how when the boy dribbles, he looks like he's dancing, how he's got capoeira in his hips, how his feet have never learned to fatigue. Capoeira, the Brazilian martial arts form where they're doing hands-free cartwheels, for instance. What an image. This is not all about oppression.
No, certainly. I think that was really important for me. You know, I think to put it in historical context, the first slaves were brought to this country in 1619. The Emancipation Proclamation was signed in 1863. Civil War ended in 1865. The Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act were 1964 and 1965. And so there have only been 50 years in which black people have even had a semblance of legal and legislative freedom in this country. And for seven times longer than that, for 350 years prior, it was fundamentally legal to discriminate against, to dehumanize, and to delegitimize the rights of black people in this country. And I don't think we put it in that arc of time often enough. But the thing is that amid all of that, amid a history in which black people have been subjected to an onslaught of incessant violence, we have still so remarkably embedded ourselves into the social and cultural fabric of this country. And to me, that's remarkable. And, you know, I grew up in a home full of joy, affirmation, laughter, and I wanted to capture that as well. And kind of like I said before, we are not singularly defined by that which seeks to kill us or that which seeks to render us obsolete. And what I didn't want to do was write a book that would at all suggest that the definitive metric of what it meant to be black in this country was the violence you experience. And one of the most important things is to remember that although we have been subjected to violence, although that is a real and fundamental part of the sort of diasporic experience in this country, another huge part of that is all that we have done in spite of it, and all the joy that we have cultivated in the midst of an otherwise very violent world.
So when a young man ties his shoelaces to go play basketball, the loops fall on either side of his foot like halos. Mm. You make him an angel.
Indeed.
That's Clint Smith. We'll link you to his 2015 TED Talk and more about his first book of poetry, Counting Dissent. Clint, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In a story we've been watching unfold much of the day, 9 people have now been transported to the hospital. One is in critical condition after an attack at Ohio State University. Earlier today, OSU officials tweeted, "Active shooter on campus, run, hide, fight, Watts Hall, 19th and College." Later, they told students to continue to shelter in place on North Campus. Cassidy Baker is a senior at OSU. She says she saw first responders on the scene helping victims.
Someone was lying on the ground and there were policemen or paramedics maybe helping them. I don't know what they were doing.
That's some sound from the Associated Press. NPR's Phil Ewing has been keeping track of all this. Phil, what do we know at this point?
Not much more than what you said. It's a very confused situation in Columbus, home of Ohio State and also the capital of Ohio. We know those victims were transported to area hospitals after some kind of attack at Ohio State. We don't know the nature of the attack. We don't know much more about what might have motivated the attack or how many people were involved. And we're waiting for a briefing from officials in Columbus, from the city of Columbus, from Ohio State, to learn more of those details.
Yeah, there's all sorts of reports floating around about what kind of weapons might be used. But again, nothing's been officially delivered to us. So
that's right.
What do we know? I mean, the shelter-in-place order has been lifted. Are there still closures on campus?
There are still closures on campus, and there's some police activity as bomb squad units and tactical teams look through campus buildings to make sure everyone is okay and make sure all the students who might have been sheltering in place before got out safely. And we know that classes were canceled in Columbus today for Ohio State University students as this big investigation takes place. This was a huge response by law enforcement, campus police, city police, Franklin County Sheriff's Office deputies, the FBI, the ATF, and other such agencies. All were involved, and now they'll try and figure out what actually happened and where they go from here.
Well, as we mentioned, the campus tweeted out, "Run, hide, fight." Pretty chilling. And we've reported on this Homeland Security recommended strategy. I've got it up here on a screen. Run, have an escape route, leave your belongings behind, keep your hands visible, hide, block entry to your hiding place, lock the door, silence your cell phone, fight as a last resort, you know, act with physical aggression, throw items at the active shooter, even if it's just coffee or pens. And that's from the Homeland Security website. But is that common for a school or a business to actually tweet that out?
Well, institutions around the country, sadly, have had to prepare plans in case of mass events like a shooting or an attack. And this is the kind of thumbnail guidance that law enforcement officials especially really like, because it's a little sketch. It's like when you tell kids in kindergarten, stop, drop, and roll. It's easy to remember, simple instructions. And in the crisis, in the moments after a crisis like this, a shooting, they want those precise, quick little thumbnail instructions to be able to give to people to tell them what to do in what can be an unimaginably terrifying situation.
Yeah. NPR's Phil Ewing on today's attack on the Ohio State University campus, an active shooter situation, according to the school, which is now over, but questions still linger, and we'll bring answers to you as we get them. Phil, thank you.
Thank you.
One of President-elect Donald Trump's plans for job creation is a massive infrastructure project. The country's roads and bridges are in disrepair. The Obama administration also pushed infrastructure but ran into spending roadblocks. Trump's plan will look beyond government dollars to public-private partnerships, tax breaks to encourage companies to get involved, and borrowing an idea long favored by Democrats and candidate Hillary Clinton, he would work to create an infrastructure bank. Congress would put in seed money. Companies would match it. Now, Trump advisors say his proposals could inject around $1 trillion over 10 years into building. Democrats say they want to work with Trump to improve the country's infrastructure. Some Republicans worry about the price tag. David Levinson is faculty at the University of Minnesota, Department of Civil, Environmental, and Geoengineering. He's also author of the book The End of Traffic and the Future of Transport, and writes the blog Transportist. He joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start with what's got a lot of people thinking. Donald Trump's use of a public-private partnership. What might that mean?
It's used today to mean a number of different ways of providing infrastructure, ranging from something as simple as what's called design-build, so that a single firm is responsible for both designing the bridge and building it, which speeds up the process and ensures that there's a single point of responsibility. So you don't have one company or one agency doing the design and a second agency doing the construction, and then people complain because there's some miscommunication. It can also be design, build, operate, and maintain. Mm. And then the firm that builds the bridge is responsible for operating and maintaining it over a long period of time. And so they don't build it cheap and then let it fail early, because they're going to pay for that cost if they're responsible for maintaining it. And presumably that leads to a higher quality of infrastructure and lower lifetime costs.
Does that mean, for instance, that a company might build the highway but also own the tolls?
It could be a toll-funded project, but it doesn't have to be. Tolls don't always cover the costs of any given infrastructure project. They do in some cases, but as you can see looking at the United States, most roads are not tolled, most bridges are not tolled. And putting a single toll bridge out there might not work from an economic perspective if there's nearby alternatives, but it still may be worthwhile to have the infrastructure. So the state might step in and, instead of paying for the road itself and maintaining itself, it pays the firm to do this, and it pays it some amount of money each year, and the firm is responsible for maintaining it to a certain performance standard.
And so what are the arguments for and against this private involvement in America's infrastructure?
Well, the argument in favor of it would be that if the firm is responsible for financing and gets paid back over time, that might help a cash-strapped local government or state government provide infrastructure that it otherwise couldn't provide without borrowing the money. And borrowing is often difficult for local and state governments because there's rules and regulations that different states have. On the downside, there's a question of who bears the risk. The negotiation of this is not just a negotiation over how much money does somebody get to be paid, but what happens if the tolls that are expected don't come in? What happens if the demand that's expected on the road doesn't materialize? How do you deal with that? And that's one of the major issues in public-private partnerships.
We're reading that in some of the current projects or past projects, one might have gone bankrupt, others just weren't finished. So that feeling of accountability gets a little bit lost if it's a private company.
Right. I mean, it depends very much on how it's organized. It doesn't have to be a new project. So you can have a sale of an existing asset as well. So a few years back, Indiana sold the Indiana Tollway and got a large upfront set of money, which then it used to build other infrastructure. And in exchange, the firm that purchased the toll road collected the tolls over a long period of time. It turned out that they did this just before the Great Recession. Demand turned down, and it especially turned down on that road because they raised the tolls more on that road because they're a private firm and were trying to collect more money. And as a result, they had to go through bankruptcy, essentially. The road didn't disappear. It continued to provide service. And that's, you know, one of the great things about infrastructure. Even if the firm goes bankrupt, the asset is still there. It's not like they can pick up the road and move it to Australia or something. So a lot of them haven't worked out financially in the last decade and a half in the U.S. It doesn't mean they can't, but it means that it's a difficult proposition.
But what about the fact that Trump's plan calls for a huge tax credit for private investors? And, you know, the hope there is that it'll bring more investors. But economists who looked at this said you'd need something like $137 billion in federal tax breaks to attract $1 trillion in infrastructure finance.
Yeah. So the proposal that was put out by Trump's team before the election is a bit of a shell game, because the assumption is that the federal government will provide these tax credits to these private companies who will then raise money and build infrastructure, and that the tax credits will presumably, the claim is, they'll be offset by greater revenue that comes into the federal treasury because of income tax, because there's workers now who are working on it who otherwise wouldn't have been. And that's a little bit disingenuous in a full employment economy, because these resources would otherwise be used. The workers would be working on something. If they weren't working on this road, they'd be working on a different road. So there would be profits and there would be income taxes that would be coming into the federal treasury anyway that aren't going to be if they're reallocated to this. Now, if they were otherwise unemployed, so if we were in the depths of a recession, and then you're employing them and otherwise they'd be idle, then something like this would make a little bit more sense, because you then would be getting revenue that otherwise wouldn't happen. But doing a stimulus when the unemployment rate is 4.9% is very different than doing a stimulus when the unemployment rate is 11%.
Well, explain that to us, because there's a huge disconnect there. We know that this recent election was propelled by people who were crying out that their industry had left the Rust Belt and their coal mines were closing. And the promise of a Donald Trump was that he would put these people to work. But then we've also recently reported on the fact that there really aren't enough workers right now to do huge infrastructure projects. Is that because, you know, we were reminded back in the 1930s with the Works Progress Administration, when thousands of largely men were hired to go out and build dams and things, they were hands-on digging ditches. And that's really not the work that's available in construction today.
Right. So when we see the grainy black and white films from the 1930s, we see thousands and thousands of people with hand shovels digging ditches and leveling roads and doing things like that. And today, road construction and all construction is much more capital intensive. It uses big equipment to do things. And so where previously it might have taken 100 men with a shovel, now it takes one construction worker with a large piece of construction equipment, a bulldozer, a backhoe, something like that, to move as much dirt. Our mental model of building infrastructure, which was formed from the 1930s and the Great Depression, doesn't apply in a world where we have a lot of automation and we still have a lot fewer people required to build the same length of road as we used to. Another important difference is, where does the unemployment occur? The areas of need of new infrastructure are in larger cities and in areas that are doing economically very well. And the areas of excess labor are in other parts of the country. Do those people want to relocate? It might not be cost-effective personally for them to do that, because living in the big city is a lot more expensive than living in a rural area. There's also skills required. Construction is not an unskilled work. I mean, it might not require a college degree, but there's a lot of skill that's required in building a road properly, and that needs to be understood by the workers who have gained experience over time building roads. And the people who build roads are different than the people who build railroads, or different than the people who build storm sewers and water pipelines.
As someone who's looked at this, what would be the best infrastructure plan to create the jobs for the people in this country who desperately need them right now?
I think you need to separate out two things. One is, what is the best plan to create new jobs for people in the country? And the second is, what is the best infrastructure plan? Because those don't necessarily align. And if we think of infrastructure as a jobs program, we're going to build things that are expensive, but we're not going to think about the long-term effects of it, because infrastructure, sure, there's a large upfront cost of building it. But 10 years from now, you have to resurface it. And 20 years from now, you need to rebuild the road. And 50 years from now, you need to rebuild the bridges. Who's going to pay for those costs? That needs to be considered when you're making a decision as to whether something's worth doing. As a private investor, if you were looking at remodeling your house and the construction firm said to you, we'll use 20 workers, and another came to you and said, we'll use 10 workers, you'd probably go with a firm that used 10 workers because their costs would be lower. And if we are thinking about this as a jobs program, we're going to maximize the inefficiency of the construction rather than trying to make it as efficient as possible. So we might want to think about jobs programs in other fields, things that require a lot of person-to-person interaction. We can think of various types of service jobs, which don't have this long-term maintenance costs and this long-term reconstruction obligations that are going to be put on us by building infrastructure, which is, from a transportation perspective, for which we want to be as efficient as possible so that we can move as many people as quickly and as safely as possible.
That's David Levinson, faculty at the University of Minnesota Department of Civil, Environmental, and Geoengineering, and author of the book The End of Traffic and the Future of Transport. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's talk about vouchers and how they could change public education and healthcare in America. That's because President-elect Donald Trump's pick for Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, has long made school choice and vouchers central to her education advocacy. And in healthcare, House Speaker Paul Ryan has pushed for something similar to a voucher system for Medicare. With a GOP-controlled Congress, that may be closer to reality. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us, as he does every Monday. Hi there, Derek.
Hello.
So first of all, let's start with education and school vouchers. What are they and how do they work?
Yes. So public school means that public money pays for the schools, and private school means that mostly private money pays for the schools. Vouchers are public money which goes to the parents to pay for private schools. So a school voucher program takes money that might otherwise go to public schools, often gives it to parents to use at their school of choice. And the school of choice can include for-profit schools, religious schools, so-called virtual schools, which means online elementary schools for homeschooled students. So it is a blend of the two systems which with most Americans are familiar.
Now, the president-elect's pick for education secretary, as we mentioned, Betsy DeVos, has long been an advocate of vouchers for K through 12 education. I mean, would her version of it be exactly as you said, that the parents could use the money for any type of school, public, private, parochial, charter?
Right. She's been an advocate for vouchers since her time in Michigan. And it's interesting because on the one hand, I think there are some attractively intuitive reasons why vouchers would be good for Americans. Vouchers seem to uphold sort of quintessentially American values of choice and competition and family control. But, a very big but, there is another important American value, which is evidence. And the evidence on vouchers from Michigan and Louisiana and Indiana and other states is just not there right now. Low-income students who entered voucher programs in these states saw their test scores decline tremendously. Why might this be happening? Well, one reason is that if you give out vouchers, which are a fixed amount of support for families, potentially you have a lot of the richer students clustering in richer schools, which means you have less great schools, less expensive schools, where a lot of the lower-income students are clustering. And if those schools don't have great oversight, then it's not likely that they're going to be very good for helping low-income kids sort of, you know, learn learn that which they might have been sort of taken away from earlier in their education. So, you know, Michigan's experience here has been quite dismal, in fact.
Interesting. So let's move over to healthcare and Medicare, because for quite some time, House Speaker Paul Ryan has pushed for something similar to a voucher system. Of course, we should talk about how controversial that word is, of course, because Republicans call it premium support. So how would that work in Paul Ryan's plan and view for the future of Medicare?
Yeah, let me set this up a bit. Today, Medicare provides health care to senior citizens. I think most people know that. As a result, though, as a country gets older and medicine becomes more expensive, Medicare costs grow quite a bit. And so Ryan and other Republicans want to constrain costs by changing the relationship between the government, patients, and insurance. Rather than be enrolled automatically in one big insurance program, Medicare, you would get a certain amount of money from the government under Ryan's plan to choose an insurance program from a marketplace that would include private insurance companies. So once again, we can imagine how this might be good. Maybe competition drives down prices and creates a better service. But there are ways also to imagine that this might be very bad. Medicare is extremely popular, and it is open-ended and automatic. You are enrolled automatically. If it's replaced with a fixed amount of government support, then that means that you might have lower-income senior citizens who end up signing up for worse health care plans, which means that you don't have the kind of equality that we have for senior citizens over the age who are enrolled in Medicare. So there are clear downsides to this that I think liberals and Democrats have pointed out. In particular, there are downsides because Medicare is already an extremely popular program.
Well, and there's also the issue of whether or not the premium support or vouchers would maintain pace with the rate of cost increase for healthcare overall, right? Because healthcare in many years in this decade, at least, has risen at a faster pace than even the consumer price index, for example.
Yes, that is exactly right. And what is a good way to cut costs for healthcare spending for senior citizens? It is to reduce the size of this check. So the same way, let's take Social Security as an example. In Social Security, if you want to reduce Social Security spending from the federal government standpoint, what you do is you slow the rate of growth of the Social Security check so that over time, older people, retired people can buy less food, buy less gas, buy less house, etc. You might try to do the exact same thing with a Medicare voucher or with Medicare premium support, as Ryan calls it. You shrink the size of the check, which means that lower-income people who don't have a lot of savings can't buy the same kind of health care insurance coverage that they can buy today. So it is rather explicitly under Ryan and some conservatives a way to save money over time, but unfortunately one which I think and a lot of other people think is going to fall disproportionately on the low income and the middle class, because they're not going to be able to get the kind of health care that we have guaranteed senior citizens for the last half century.
Well, Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.